You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Light our flame today to ignite our hearts and minds, the spark of knowledge that enlightens, the shimmering hope that burns, the blazing love that engulfs our actions, the bonfire of our commitment. We light this flame for those who celebrate themselves, who fear, who hope, who persevere, who stand on the side of love for all. We light this flame for those who have been ridiculed, that they may find peace. For those who have fought to marry, that they may celebrate. For those who live in uncertainty in the world, that they may have hope. We light this flame to renew our commitment that no one shall ever again suffer for the right to love as they choose. We light this flame to celebrate our kaleidoscope of diversity, working, loving, and living on the side of love. For this, we light this morning's flame. Well, good morning and welcome to our service of worship. This is a service because it means to be of service to you. And this is worship because we raise to worth things that matter. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church. And I welcome you here on behalf of generations of Unitarians who have worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. We are a spiritual community that encourages and supports all who come to find, to fashion, and most importantly, to follow their own spiritual path. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all.
When we talk about a liberal theology and ethic of sexuality, we need to start in our vulnerable, needy bodies, in real life, in the struggle to navigate our embodied neediness with others, in an embrace of the still possible mutual wholeness. Any theology of sex that doesn't start with the body fails to address those implicit and enduring messages many of us and our culture carry. Early Christian thinkers, influenced by Plato, Aristotle, and Hellenism, imagined human life dualistically, body and soul separate. The soul was eternal and of God. The body was sinful, and to be overcome in service of saving the soul. From the liberal theological anthropology, that is an understanding of the human person, refuses to separate the parts in any way, but rather approaches humanity as one of body, mind, spirit, all in one, all connected, all alive, indivisible, all gifts of God or of the universe, all worthy of love and belonging, inherently so, as we say. The body is not something to be overcome in this framework, but it's rather to be honoured, respected, loved. Its regular workings and needs are not shameful or dirty or requiring purification or containment. Bodies are funny. mysterious, beautiful, messy, changing. Us humans are funny, mysterious, beautiful, messy, and changing. That bodies become hungry for food or for touch is simply true. Not good, not bad, just true. That bodies take pleasure in food or touch is also true. Still not inherently good or bad, just true. Most of all, bodies, as they are indivisibly life, humanity, personhood, are vulnerable as life is vulnerable. We go to great lengths to control and avoid this reality, to assert and appear otherwise. But all of us, are so terribly vulnerable. We're susceptible to illness, injury, aging. Our hearts hurt, literally or figuratively, often both, and often the distinction is imperceptible. Bodies that hurt can also be healed. And because bodies and spirits and minds are one, the hurt may show itself in a particular place, yet the pain will be felt everywhere, distinctly unlovely and undesirable. So too, the healing everywhere, exquisitely consoled. In the midst of all the ways that life tears us apart, sex can pull our pieces back together, tenderly, clumsily, beautifully. And when it does, whether in the context of casual or committed relationships, sex can be holy and sacred.
Thank you, Barbara. This is a story of three interconnected journeys which trace the same spiritual arc toward greater love, greater acceptance, greater inclusion. One is a personal journey. The second is the journey of our Unitarian movement. And finally, the journey of this church over recent years. First, the personal journey. The world I was born into was a very black and white world with very strict limiting conditions. I was born white, male, Catholic, working class, and American. Given conditions, I can no more change than I can change my eye color. In this black and white world, such conditions as these work like a kind of a control system, enforced and maintained by a fear and loathing of whatever the opposite was. So if you were born white, fear and loathing of non-whites. If you were born American, fear and loathing of communism, godless communism. If you were born working class, fear and loathing of being poor or seeming to be poor. And if you were born Catholic, fear and loathing of non-Catholics. But my maleness was also enforced and maintained by fear and loathing of the opposite of what male was supposed to mean. So, fear and loathing of being weak and vulnerable. Fear and loathing of being without mates. And after puberty, fear and loathing of being without dates. Those black and white conditions together formed a kind of thick network of interrelated power structure that encouraged and discouraged certain identities, some acceptable and some not. The worst thing a male could be considered in that black and white world I grew up in was not a punk, was not a redneck, was not an idiot, was not even being a killer, After all, we had lots of folk heroes who were cold-blooded killers, much like Ned Kelly. No, the worst, the most excluding thing for a male by far in that black and white world was to be considered homosexual. There was no nuance. There was no gray area. There was no middle ground. It was a dualism. You either were or you weren't. So, of course, in that fear-governed dualistic world, you spent a lot of time and energy in unspoken, unacknowledged, and even unconscious ways to avoid giving anyone any reason to consider you that. The problem, of course, is that black and white sexual identities, like the monogamous marriage, are made for a particular social order, and not necessarily for the flourishing of every once-in-an-eternity unique person in that social order. Freud, among others, observed that the human infant is born with a sexuality that is very different from that of the adult. The fleshy hardware you get before the software of socialization is installed seeks pleasurable sensations wherever it can get them. The infant knows not from straight or gay. The infant knows not from normative shoulds or prohibitive no-nos. Not yet. You learn soon enough through normal, explicit conditioning from family and peers and institutions, and from the implicit modeling you see all around you in cultural and media messages. Married mommies and daddies are normal, natural, and right, and things outside of that are not. But infant psychology suggests that human sexuality isn't inherently black and white, either or matter at all, but a spectrum along which you discover and locate your identity as you become socialized into adulthood. So that's exclusive heterosexuality on the left, exclusive homosexuality on the right, and all the shades in between. Now, since each one of us is utterly unique, we will construct and locate ourselves within this tension between what's socially acceptable and the emerging awareness you have of your own uniqueness. So where you came from doesn't have to be who you are. Your origins are not your identity, and neither are your origins your destiny. You can't choose your origins, but you can choose what you make of those origins, and thereby rightly take a bit of pride, not so much in your beginnings, but in who you uniquely become. This is true of individuals, like me, and true of groups and churches and religions, as we'll explore in a moment. So, despite my black and white environment I grew up in, I found I took pleasure in things that were colorful. Things like music and acting and theater and art and books and, you know, dressing up well. And from a fairly early age, I began to move in these activities and in the social circles that came from them. And that meant that these tastes called my male identity into question, and my sexual identity, of course, no matter how strenuously I pursued girls. So I began to wonder myself, maybe I really am, you know, gay, as folks seem to be suggesting all around me. It was the 70s, after all, and it was after the Stonewall riots in the States. So, you know, one was aware that there were folks out there who took pride in identifying as gay and with whom I seemed to have a lot in common. So there were some years of confusion before I came out in the early 80s, during which confused time I wasn't 100% sure if I was gay or straight or what. I mean, some of the guys I slept with were gay, and a few of the girls slept with other girls, too, but that didn't necessarily make me gay, did it? A few of those guys still are, of course. Some are not. One of them transitioned a few years ago. One of the, I guess she was giving the lesbian thing a go, decided to go back into a heteronormative marriage and bear a litter of kids. And looking back, I can see that many of the people I have loved have displayed a whole spread of identities and sexually loving relationships. And these emerged despite, or maybe they emerged because of, the social pressure to conform to some sort of black and white identity. There seemed to be a spectrum of partnership options if you thought yourself a free spirit. So, for example, some alternatives to black and white monogamy I've known. Just as a side note, there's a small but persistent and growing polyamory movement among Unitarians in Hawaii and California. So looking back on the people I've known in my life and the relationships I know, there's been this whole spectrum of possibilities that didn't fit neatly into the black and white Lucy and Ricky marriage type category. Thankfully, I was part of a subculture in the arts that was accepting and even encouraging of sexual diversity. The arts subculture, I'm not talking about religion, of course. Religion, on the whole, has been terribly slow to accept anything but a narrow conformity and a mind-body dualism. You can read the cartoon, I'm sure. Religion, on the whole, has at best been terribly slow to accept anything but this narrow conformity. And at worst, religion has been a major source of social exclusion and body shaming. But the arts world has always been more accepting of the complexity of sexual diversity and gender identities. Now, after a time in that world as a young adult, I came to think, you know, what business is it of anybody's what two or more consenting adults get up to in private? What business is it of anybody's what identity a person feels most fully themselves in? And the one and only correct answer I could ever think of was, none of anybody's business. And through spending some formative years in that world, I came to see sexual identity as that spectrum along which I could understand and accept sexual diversity and locate my truest sense of my truest self. So one day, it just became clear to me, and I came out as straight, mostly, about 80-85%, so it's sort of that end of it, because extremes are, well, extreme, and there's no denying that in my youth in the 70s, certain things did happen, and I did not dislike them. I am rather proud of that journey to an identity because I wasn't handed that identity. I both discovered and made that identity. And anyone's journey to the consciousness of their own identity and how that identity relates to others is certainly a journey with a spiritual dimension. And the second journey I mentioned, the journey of our own beloved Unitarian movement, is also, coincidentally, over the last 50 years, has been a spiritual journey bound up with sexual identities. Unitarianism is allied to no dogma but love, in whatever form that comes. And we have been at the forefront of developing and publicly witnessing a progressive sexual theology, focusing on reaching out in love and inclusiveness to all, regardless of sexuality or gender identity. For Unitarians, more love is always to be sought after. More love is always to be valued. More love is always to be celebrated. The hymn is, "There is more love somewhere." Please stand as you're able. Every year all over the world, the LGBTQ community has a Pride March, a public event that pushes back in joyful celebration against the cultural shaming, vilification, and outright persecution they have endured. The LGBTQ struggle for equality and justice is a key touchstone in the history of civil and religious freedom everywhere. And we should take great pride in the fact that Unitarianism has been at the vanguard of the struggle for LGBTQ equality and justice. Our movement is a movement with a lot of firsts in this area. The Our Whole Lives OWL program is now a fully inclusive program about sexuality from preschool right through adults. It grew out of this 1971 youth project. A lot of firsts. I came to terms with my own sexual identity in the 1980s. If I'd only discovered Unitarianism in the early 90s, maybe if I'd found Unitarianism earlier, I could have come to my own sexual consciousness sooner rather than later, and with a bit less theological confusion about it. The Unitarian journey over the last 50 years has always shown an intention toward fuller inclusion. Our faith tradition I cannot emphasize this enough. Our faith tradition is thus a proud story of religious leadership, not followership. The third story, the story of our own beloved little Unitarian Church, has not exactly been in pace and in step with that wider movement in becoming fully welcoming to the LGBTQ community. Some of you may remember at the very start of this ministry, I sought to engage the LGBTQ community locally by writing a column in the LGBT street press called Blaze, a column called Theology and Sexuality, featuring a shamelessly out-of-date headshot. In every article, I applied our progressive theology to different issues of sexuality. I proudly plugged our movement's LGBTQ credentials. I made explicit invitations in the articles, promising a warm welcome to everybody. And it worked! Sort of. Proudly out Blaze readers, fellow Blaze columnists, and their friends and family began checking us out in twos or threes, safety in numbers, which should tell you something about the welcome that these people expected to receive in a church. Some came several times, which was encouraging, and this sort of stumbled along for about a year and then stopped, suddenly and completely. I couldn't understand it. I met with the editor, and the editor, to whom these people talked, could not have been more explicit. Yeah, they get that your theology is progressive and that you're open and everyone's safe there, but no one spoke to them. Some wouldn't even make eye contact. You say they're welcome, but the church didn't engage with them as, you know, just people seeking fellowship. And this was entirely my fault. Because in the zeal of having a new ministry, I led by racing ahead quite on my own, leaving the team behind. I had overlooked a classic trap for young players. You can't make people ready for something before they're actually ready for it. Sometimes journeys just take the time they take. So I abandoned the column and concentrated instead on changing the culture here, which was going to take longer and require rather more than writing a column or turning up to speak at marriage equality rallies or putting up a banner and hoping that people could read between the lines. Changing our culture has meant becoming more outward-facing rather than inward, becoming more joyful rather than somber, and becoming more about love, our only real theology, than about the sterile debating of ideas. Well, a lot has changed within these walls since that column ended, and that change has been boosted by two truly pivotal moments that we can look back on with button-busting pride. Because in the past couple of years, two members of this church felt safe enough and welcome enough to come out as transgender in the sacred space of our services. In the whole 160-year history of this church, that is a huge step forward. So we are ready now, I think, to join the majority of Unitarian churches in officially becoming what's known as a welcoming church, a welcoming congregation. Now, if you don't know what that is, this is what it is. It's a formal program for member churches to make sure lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people are full members of our faith communities. It means a church is striving for radical inclusion and creating spaces that honor every part of our identities, backgrounds, and experiences. It began in 1990, formally. Now, that might not seem long ago to you, but it's 28 years ago. So dig it. 95% of our Unitarian churches of 150 or more members are welcoming churches. 95%. But only 50% of Unitarian churches under 150 members are welcoming churches. Thus, our church has been stuck at the cusp of a critical mass. The 2020 committee will be seeing this formal process through to completion, and we will be able to display this banner soon in good conscience and in truth and in good faith. As we move forward with our public identity strategy, our welcoming church status is going to be one of our key identifiers to the wider community. But. Won't that make this a gay church? I'd invite you to look around you at the world. will be a gay church like it's a gay world. It is a gay world and a straight world. It's a world of human people and thus a diverse world where everyone is needed because no one's experience of loving and living in joy and dignity is right or complete. Enter, rejoice, and come in, we say. Come in. Yes, hell, come out if you want. We're all in this life together anyway. Why not make a place at our table for everyone? But. I am not gay and may not feel welcome in such a church. Well, that's exactly been the reality the LGBT community have been experiencing since the year dot. If you don't like being excluded yourself, and who does, maybe don't exclude others. It's not good enough to be not homophobic passively. Our first principle directs us to be anti-homophobic. That's the first principle. To publicly witness this principle, I'm asking you personally, and I'm going to be looking for you, I'm urging you to join the many of us who will be standing on the side of love at the Adelaide Pride March on November 10th. This isn't a grim duty by any means. Pride marches are fun, and it will be fun for us to do this together. Our journey to coming out as a welcoming church has taken the time it's taken. But we can take pride in the fact that being truly, madly, queerly, publicly welcoming is who we truly are now. Praise be. The hymn is Standing on the Side of Love. Please stand as you're able.
The promise of the Spirit, faith, hope, and love abide.
May we do our part to help heal the fear, hate, and judgment that have wounded so many. May we know deeply and certainly that love transcends all labels. Love transcends all categories. Love transcends all words. Love is. Love is in all of us. May we each bring our whole selves and come together in love, which binds us and heals us all. Amen, and have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.